once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Both of us today are really slow and low on energy.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So hopefully we'll be able to keep the energy up, but if we start to peter out, give us a call and wake up our semi-somnolent brains. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. Do you wish to do the disclosures?
All right, we can do this. Let's see. First off, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only an excitingly dramatic.
Is that like laundromat?
Yeah, it's very dry, right. And it's matic.
It's definitely not dynamic.
How about dramatic?
Or dramatic. They're neither dynamic nor dramatic, mostly dry-matic.
Yes. It's a radio program where a couple of guys endlessly, or at least for 2 hours, discuss each week the vagaries of the financial and economic world, otherwise known as the dismal science, and try to put people to sleep. The other thing it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm. Registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which neither approves nor disapproves and will deny all knowledge, Mr. Secretary.
Forcefully so.
Forcefully. In Salado, Texas. However, the information we present on this radio program is not investment advice. It is instead educational information. Do you like that? Educational information. That sounds so smooth. I worked on that. And investment advice is given based on your individual circumstances, goals, and objectives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas education is general in nature, and the information we do present educationally has been obtained from sources we believe to be deem to be reliable.
Right.
But we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of the information
warranty,
we present.
Guarantee, accuracy, completeness. Okay.
Got it. And there's one more. One more disclosure. We are not paid to do this radio program, nor do we pay the radio station to do the radio program. However, we do advertise for the radio program on the station.
Yes.
You can figure out why we need to say that. I'm sure there's a very good reason we need to say
that. It's important. Even if we're not getting paid, they need to know we're not getting paid. That's
right.
Part of the deal.
And that we're not paying for this.
Right.
Which it makes us weird.
Yeah. So this is not sponsored, except that
it is.
We do have some.
We have advertisements.
Yes. We sponsor it ourselves, I guess, but not in the traditional sense.
But we don't run our advertisements on the show.
Right. Very interesting.
Weird. We got to think about that. This is a very deeply philosophical question.
Got a few more disclosures to throw
up. Okay, go
there too.
Throw up if you want to.
Yes, so I'm going to throw up some disclosures. Hold on a moment. Coffee, when served hot, may be hot. Ice may be cold to the touch. Please avoid switching salt and sugar. Bad results could occur. Thank you. There. We have disclosed all that I can imagine. There is more imagination coming, though, so
they do need some information, though. If today is occurring in the month of October 2019.
And it's the 26th of that month.
And it's the 26th. In other words, it's about 4 days before Halloween, which is critical. Then you're welcome to give us a call.
I like how you said about, because it's not really 4 days. But go ahead.
Well, it all depends. I mean, time is variable. Time moves around, and it's not precise, and it's a little scary sometimes.
So you said about 4 days to Halloween. Well, most people would consider it 5 days to Halloween, except if you live on the other side of the international dateline.
Well, if you think that today is already going through, and there's four days hence, if today is over, would be Halloween. So it's about 4.5 days to Halloween.
The day after the fourth day would be from today.
Well, it's the 26th, and between 26 and 30,
shall we count it up? This is economists arguing with about.
So, do we count today in the days to Halloween?
Which day is Halloween? Let's make sure we have the same definition for Halloween first.
Oh, that's right. I was thinking about 30th. It's not the 30th. It's the 31st.
There we are.
That's my problem.
So common definition.
5 days.
Yeah.
And it's all Octavian's fault.
Yes. Oh, Augustus.
Yes. Because if he just left the
calendar alone.
Calendar alone.
His adopted father posthumously set it up very, very nicely. Julius said 10 months. That's why in Latin, the number 10 is dec. If you think of the last month of the year being December, it's because it's supposed to be the 10th month. And if you think all the way back, I mean, you've got September and October. Sept is 7, Oct is 8, November. So you've got some extra months in there. If Oct is 8 and October is the 10th month, what happened? Well, Augustus, after he changed his name, decided to add a couple of months to the year in honor of himself and his posthumously adopted father.
Actually, he was adopted before his father died.
He was adopted in the will.
In the will?
Yeah.
Oh.
Julius Caesar.
I didn't know you could do that.
Adopted in his will. So he was posthumously a father.
That's really interesting. I don't think you can do that in Texas law, so we shouldn't recognize it.
He also had a son by Cleopatra, but he didn't know about that yet.
Hmm.
How's that for weirdness? Okay, so we added a couple of months to the year, and that's why things are weird.
Well, we didn't add them.
July is Julius. August is Augustus.
Actually, it was originally was Julius was the month, and then the next month that followed was Augustus.
Yeah.
We ought to take them back to that. It makes sense. Anyway, if we never got to the end of that sentence, if today is the 26th of October, 5 days before Halloween.
We've got that clarified.
2019.
Though. Very well clarified.
Yes. Then you're welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400. See, you've learned all kinds of interesting things already, and you've only been listening to the show.
We are brilliant. We may just not know what day it is or what day it's going to be.
Or what day something else is going to happen.
So how brilliant does that really make us?
Well, you know, if somebody says, what day is it, you should say where.
that's actually
you say, what time it is.
Fantastic.
What time is it? You really need to say where.
And we haven't said this on the air for a while.
We haven't?
No, this is a good one. If you can look up at the sky and see the moon, for a big chunk of the day, you're seeing tomorrow.
Well, about 6 hours.
Yeah. Well, 6 hours if you're in central time.
Yeah.
Texas, if you're in daylight savings time, if you look up and you see the moon and it's after 6 in the evening, you're looking at the moon, and the moon's time zone is the same time zone as the UK, which is 6 hours ahead of us. Which means it's tomorrow.
Right.
Why did the moon get to have the UK time? Because back when they called it Greenwich Mean Time, that was zero. And we're plus 6.
And it's now called Universal Coordinated Time.
Because that makes as much sense, obviously.
Which doesn't make any sense at all, because if any place in the world is uncoordinated, it's Britain.
Right. And it seems a little bit arrogant to call it universal we're talking about one planet.
Since all the astronomers got together a long time ago, like 100 years ago.
All of them.
And all of them in the International Astronomical Association.
Oh, yes. They got together and
they determined that we would set a time for the universe.
Universal
time. Zone.
And we're going to base it on how long it takes us to move around our star. And the rest of the universe just has to grin and bear it.
And we set the time to be the time in London.
Yes.
Which is the same time
as
it
you
is
would.
In Greenwich.
Yes, as you would. I mean,
right.
Why not?
It was the center of the world, clearly.
Where would it be today?
I don't know. That would be, you know, it's kind of like if you're at the North Pole and you've got all these time zones. You've got 24 time zones that are running around and you're standing right at the, or the South Pole. But it's
right.
probably easier to stand at the South Pole because it's not moving around. you could stake a – what time is it at the South Pole? By the way, it's UCT is also used, or Greenwich Mean
right.
Time.
Right, so it's the same South time but, at the South Pole as it is on the moon. The whole moon, because they, right. they don't have time zones on the moon,
but
just
the
one.
The point is, as soon as you step away from the South Pole, you're technically in some time zone, so you could go through 24 time zones by walking in a small circle.
You know, no matter which way you go from the South Pole, you're going north.
Right.
Not, I mean, or you could be going left, too, but...
But you're going north.
North, for sure. You said
well,
right. So
any direction you go from there, you would have left the South Pole. So any direction is left.
Yes. So we are. We told you we were low on energy. This is where we go when we're low on energy. This is why we like economics, because...
It works about the same way.
It's very arbitrary. Economics is what we agree it to be, just like time. And just to throw this out there, while over 100 years ago they set the center of the world, well over 100 years ago, it was in the early 1800s, they set the center of the world in Greenwich or London more specifically. But
well, actually in a line that runs from the North Pole to the South Pole that runs through the Royal Observatory at Greenwich.
Right. And at that point, the British Empire was far flung. It was big.
The sun never set on the British
right.
Empire.
So it was a pretty good standard across the empire. But that's not the reason why it really took off as far as the standard time.
It took off?
Well, it did. It's running a little fast. That's what happens when it takes off. The American railroads are the reason why we still consider London the center of the world. Because the American railroads looked around inside the United States and we had no standardized anything as far as time went.
Yeah, that was pretty good. They had sundials in towns, and when the sun was directly overhead, it was noon.
It was noon. Yeah. So instead of saying we're going to base this all on American time zones because we've got none of them, they said we're going to use these Brits. They seem to have this figured out. And not only that, we'll also figure out this thing that they have invented called queuing up or getting in line. And we'll endorse that, too. So American railroads took two major pieces of technology that the British Empire gave the world and solidified it, lines and time zones.
The other thing is the width between rails, the standard rail
this
width in the United States – came from the standard rail width in Great Britain for a very, very practical reason.
Yes.
We bought the first engines and train cars from Britain, had them shipped over here, and if we're going to lay down railroads, they have to be the same width as the wheels.
And do you know why British rails are the width they are?
I do.
Because Roman carts, 2,000 years before...
Actually, it was the chariots.
The chariots, yes, but the carts had to be the same width as the chariots because they made ruts in the rock. And you would break axles if you used a different width of your axle. So today in Europe, if you're on an old Roman road, you'll see the ruts. And those ruts mark the distance between the iron rails in the state of Texas.
And there's a reason those two ruts and the wheels are that far apart. The standardized Roman horse.
Right.
The wheels were directly behind their tails, which are attached to their rear end holes.
Really?
And
they
literally line up on the center of the horse, the two wheels, and the Russians. The Romans had a standardized horse so that they could interchange horses. They had two horses per chariot. They had a standardized axle, and they had standardized wheels so they could replace them easily and not be all out of whack. And it was the distance between two horses' asses.
Which has set
our
measurement.
US width for railroads.
Yes, of course.
And
all
we
right.
have a caller on 773-1400 who probably wants to talk about something else, I hope. And caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Oh,
wow.
Yeah, see, there it is.
This is what happens when you talk about the rear ends of horses while people are waiting on hold.
Let's talk about the markets. Well, got another call coming in. So caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Guys, enjoy the show.
You did?
I know I do enjoy the show. And I will continue to enjoy the show.
Oh, he's a determined person. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Lot of articles mentioning the 90-year anniversary of the big 29 stock market crash. One of the things they these articles mention is the cause that was people were borrowing money to buy stocks. How much of that is going on in today's market? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
That is a fantastic question.
That's a good question. There was a lot of leverage in the stock market. Yeah. Well,
that's what borrowing to buy is, leverage.
But.
And that was a big chunk of the problem in 29.
But it's a heck of a lot more complicated than that. Very frankly, I have read and read. I have spent years reading on the stock market crash in 1929. And I've concluded there is no consensus why it happened.
Now, we did a lot of things after the crash in the following decade. Congress passed a lot of laws that were effective in lowering the risk of that kind of an event leading to a depression. It's definitely not a cure-all. And one of the things that directly addresses the buying with borrowed money is something called Reg T. And Reg T, it basically, if you have a margin account in a brokerage firm, then you can borrow money and invest it. But there's a limit. You can't do more than 50%. You can't borrow more than 50% of your assets to buy more assets.
And if you actually go back and read carefully about the stock market crash in 1929, it wasn't actually as severe. The one that actually occurred on Black Monday was not as severe as the one that occurred in 1987. And it hit what appeared to be a bottom after a couple of days, after a few days, began to recover, and then continued. Then it crashed again, and it crashed again, and it crashed again. And there's a lot of complexity that went into this, but I think probably the chief thing that was going on is both the Federal Reserve and the Congress, combined with the president, were doing things that later were determined to be extremely counterproductive. They were far more concerned about inflation. The Federal Reserve was far more concerned about fighting inflation. The president was far more concerned about balancing the budget. The Congress was far more concerned about balancing the budget. So as the revenues started down, Congress raised taxes and cut spending. Because as the revenues started down to the Congress, because we didn't have an income tax at the time, and it was basically tariffs that were generating the money, they actually raised tariffs and lowered spending, which meant they effectively raised taxes and lowered spending as the stock market kept falling, and that caused unforeseen consequences. The bottom of the market didn't come until 1932, and it was down 80%, and every time it would seem to be about to stabilize, Congress or the president would do something that would trigger another collapse. It was a feedback loop.
And there is a huge factor on the leverage side of thing is the returns in the market in the 1920s were a different category of returns than we see today. We were, in essence, we were an emerging market. We were industrializing. We were going from minor Iron Age farm and agriculture country to a industrial production capable country. And that was big. So the stock market returns during that decade, the Dow, the average return was 20% a year for a decade. And that caused a lot of people to want to get in at the top. They were borrowing to get in, and so there was a big factor there, a lot, and there was no limit on how much you could borrow. You could borrow 300% of your assets.
And here's the scary part. We'd actually gone 10 years without a recession, without a major recession, without a major bear market.
Right.
Oh, I don't know. Does that ever happen?
well, we had a minor bear market. We had a short-term bear market in December of last year.
Yeah. And we have another caller on 773-1400, so you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask you, you know, back in them days when they did have that crash and a lot of people lost their money, you know, apparently a few of them or a lot of them had money in the bank. how are banks more secure now in this time and era that if we had money in the bank, you know, $100,000, whatever, you know, you're not liable to lose that money if something did happen. Is that security there that money is safe in the bank? You have a good day.
Thanks for the call.
All right. Now, let me hit that, because the stock market crash is part of the reason. A crash shouldn't cause a depression. A stock market crash shouldn't cause a depression today. Okay? I mean, crashes might be a symptom of some other problem, but in 1929, the crash happened, and there was a lot of borrowing that took place, and it was coming from all kinds of sources. When you're allowed to buy 300% of the value that you actually own in there, and then that drops and you've got to come up with the money, how do you come up with the money? Well, you sell stuff, or you grab money out of your bank account. And that was a big thing. There was a lot of money being yanked out of the banks to support that loan that the people had built up to buy more stocks and to make more money. They lost more than they invested by a lot because they borrowed. So then they had to yank money out of the bank, and they yanked a lot of money out of the bank in a very short period of time, which is what caused the runs on the bank, which then caused the next several steps that led to the depression.
There was also a general attitude after 10 years of rapidly rising stock prices that led to something that has popped up several times in my experience in the market. This could go on forever.
Right. And then when it doesn't, it's terrifying.
And people believe it will go on forever. And the last time I saw this in bold aspect was in the late 1990s, as we and into the year 2000. We saw very similar, very, very similar attitude towards the stock market as we saw in as occurred in 1929.
Yeah.
And John Bogle said all a person really needs for the one point for their retirement is an S&P 500 index fund. Well, fact is that in 2000, had you put all your money in October of 2000 into an S&P 500 index fund, and the one he was referring to was the one of Vanguard, and you adjust for inflation, it would have been 12 or 13 years before you recovered. And that is about how long it took from 1929 forward.
Yeah. One thing that is fascinating to me to show the difference between then and now, and then we'll hit what's different in the banking world. In 1929, the Dow closed at 381.2. It's not very high compared to what we see today, big numbers in the 30 plus thousand range. But 381.2 was the high on Black Thursday. And Monday happened, Tuesday happened, it had a couple of good days, and then Thursday was just the horrible, horrible, horrible day. So you had Black Monday, Black Tuesday, Wednesday, and then you had Black Thursday. Just fascinating world. So three black days on a week.
Which is not a very good term.
The low of the Dow, and this is...
Was it at 88?
41.22. It was a 90% loss from the top, from 1929 to 1932. And that says something comparatively. In the Great Recession, that this S&P 500 was down 52%.
Mm-hmm.
And it was down over a longer period of time. It was not concentrated into a couple of weeks and then more down. And then so it was a much higher concentration of badness. So it's very much, again, like an emerging market.
Could that happen again today? I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is for several reasons. One, as Jake mentioned, we have FDIC insurance at the banks.
Well, I haven't said that yet. We're about to.
Anyway, is the money at the bank safe? Yes. FDIC insurance.
As long as you have less than $250,000 right. per registration at an FDIC-insured bank, you're in good shape.
And so you say, well, where's the government going to get all the money to replace it with? Well, the government has the ability, the Federal Reserve specifically, has the ability to create money. And if money disappears, that's a really good time to start creating money.
This is another piece. Part of what we've been talking about the last several weeks and months, on the repo market, that short-term thing. And it's funny because I was talking about this 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And that's, you can go back and listen to the recordings on it. And nobody even knew what we were talking about. Now it's front page news on everything.
Well, it's front page news in the Wall Street Journal. I don't know that the Temple Daily Telegraph.
No, not Temple Daily, but Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today. They've all had multiple front page stories on the subject.
Right.
We were talking about this 3 months ago. Part of the problem is the fix to another problem. It is almost impossible for a customer run on the bank right now to cause a problem in the United States. Why? Because the Federal Reserve has mandated a very high reserve requirement. It's a record high. It's never been this high before, which means from the perspective of what got us into the Great Depression, we're immune from that. We've just set up another problem.
Sounds like a flu shot.
Right. So we solved one thing, and the side effect of the thing that we took to solve the one thing is developed a different problem. So now we have to figure out how to fix that problem. And that is economics, by the way. There is no such thing as a fix that will just cure economics. It is a constant look at how do we adjust to new technologies and new belief structures. Because that's what money is. It's our belief. It's our belief that we can buy with it. We all believe it together. That's what ownership is. And this is fascinating to me. The only thing that says that you own that laptop there that you have is our agreement that you own that laptop. There's a law, but that's just a larger group of people agreeing that you own that laptop. It's just confidence. And the stock market is only about ownership.
So you're trying to say that the stock market is a con game? Confidence game?
It is a confidence game.
So is everything else.
So is everything else. Why is it a fair price to buy something at the price that you deem it's fair? Because you believe it is.
Well, let me add some more to this. In the Great Depression, we didn't have unemployment insurance and we didn't have Social Security. And there's more to it than that.
Right. A lot more than that.
Let me say the reason that the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009 didn't become the Great Depression, one of the main reasons was Social Security. Now, you don't think about that as a cushion for the stock market or the economy, but it is, because a lot of people are drawing Social Security. A lot of people have pension funds that are protected by various insurance programs at the federal level. And the end result is you had this stream of money flowing to people that had nothing to do with whether people were unemployed or not. You also have unemployment insurance, which sometimes people gripe about all these unemployed people who get paid. But the issue is the federal government effectively has a cushion at the bottom of the economy to keep it from falling past a certain point. And during the Great Recession, one of the things that we followed and probably, again, wasn't in the Temple Daily Telegram, is the federal government's refunding and special bills being passed to fund the unemployment insurance program. And they kept refunding it, putting more money into it to keep it going. The FDIC is the same way. There is no federal law that says the federal government will support the unemployment insurance program. There is no federal law that says the Congress will step in to support the FDIC.
There's no federal law that says that the U.S. government will step in to protect Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
Right.
But they did.
And as long as that level of – as long as Congress senses it – as long as they remember 1920, as long as they remember the Great Depression, basically 19.
That's a danger these days.
Prior to whatever it's worth, and this may or may not be too relevant today, but it's an important piece of history. Prior to 1934, the Republicans dominated Congress for a long time. Basically, they dominated Congress from the time of the Civil War to 1934. And in 1934, the Republicans got turned out on their ear, and the Democrats not only got the presidency, they got both houses of Congress, and they kept them for a long time. That's how the New Deal was passed, is President Roosevelt had an overwhelming majority. There were enough Democrats in the House and the Senate that they could overcome the filibuster. They could overcome anything because the Republicans were given full credit for creating and maintaining the Great Depression. And through their fiscal activities, which really aren't greatly different than they are today. And they hopefully have learned a couple of lessons and read their history books to say, we better be in favor of not having another depression. As a matter of fact, Republicans in the 1930s, the early 1930s, made speech after speech saying this is good for us. It's weeding out the rotten, the dry, the right. dead wood.
And that may be true in short recessions. It's not true in depressions. Depressions right. eat out the good stuff too.
But they'd taken the political position that it's called laissez-faire, which is French. And as soon as you lapse into French, you probably ought to bolt for the door. It means leave it alone.
Right. And in many cases, it's a really good approach. If you think of any well-regulated society, laissez-faire is pretty good. If you want to go out and have a barbecue, you should be able to go out and have a barbecue. However, you shouldn't be allowed to murder people. So laissez-faire within reason.
The problem was they weren't only laissez-faring, they were also passing tariffs.
Which is the opposite of laissez-faire, which is to say, we're going to dictate prices. We won't set the starting price or the closing price. We're just going to add a percentage to it.
End result, a lot of bad things happen, and hopefully members of Congress have read their history books. Sometimes I don't think they have.
Congress as a whole, I think their combined IQ is some negative number.
I'm not knocking the president. I'm just simply going to quote him. He simply said, when asked if he'd read the history of something or another, he said, I don't read books, which is, that's his right. He's operating off of what he sees as right based on his gut reaction as a businessman, and that may or may not work. It's a big experiment. We'll see how it works out. But the reality is a lot of things happened 90 years ago, but I want to make a point here.
Make your point.
That's not the biggie. If you really want to see something that I think is a legitimate threat,
mm-hmm.
look what happened 100 years ago, the Depression of 1920-21. That was literally, the history books, the economics books, refer to it as a depression. That was a very short depression. It's sometimes called the Forgotten Depression. It only lasted 18 months, but it was a precursor to what was going to happen 10 years later, and it showed some of the weak points in that was going on. And most of what I have read in the popular media, including Wikipedia, is based on my reading of the economic history, inaccurate. There's a lot of things going on today in the economy and in the market that are very, very similar to what was going on in 1919. And the 1920-21 depression, which was very short but fairly severe, I think we're at some degree of risk of repeating it. Now, would it be a depression this time? No, it would be a recession. Why? Because we have all kinds of safety valves and cushions and things that weren't there in 1920 and 21. There's a peculiarity, and I really don't have a good, solid, scientific, evidence-based answer for it, but there's a peculiarity. If you look through the 19th century, you'll see that we effectively had a depression every 10 years, regular as clockwork, that was triggered in a year ending in zero. Now, we had some others too, but we had what they referred to as depressions, and they were short, they were severe, and we recovered fairly quickly. Then if you come into the 20th century and you back up, now that's not to say that it's a perfect alignment. But you look at every year ending in zero, and what do you get? You get some kind, you're in the middle of or starting an economic crisis in every year ending in zero. Why do we do that? I haven't got a clue. But it happens regularly enough that's like saying, if I didn't understand that the Earth was tilted relative its orbit around the Earth, the Earth's orbit around the sun. And if I didn't understand that, which people didn't for a long time, I could still say, with an alarming regularity, every 365 days it turns cold. And then every 365 days at a different time of the year it turns warm. And we could build a Stonehenge or some temples or something to note that when the sun gets to this point as it moves back and forth, during those times, we thought the Earth was the center of the universe and the sun rotated around the Earth.
We don't know if that's what the folks of Stonehenge believed.
Well,
it would make sense that they would think that way.
People up till actually quite recently in history believed that the Earth was stationary and the sun moved around the Earth, and for some reason or other it migrated north and south.
Yes.
And they noted that when it migrated past a certain point to the north, it got cold. And when it migrated past a certain point to the south, it got warm. And so they built temples that were perfectly aligned so they could forecast when it's going to get warm and when it's going to get cold, when you should plant stuff. Sometimes I think we're about that level. But it did happen regularly. And I don't know anybody that's come up with a really good reason why in 0 years we're in some kind of financial crisis. But we are with enough regularity, I would think that one would be concerned about it.
Some type of behavioral something happens in us that seemed to line up with that 10-year point.
May have to do with the fact that we have 10 digits.
Could be.
And that's either the numbers or the
round
fingers.
Numbers are important to us, even though $20 is just one more than 19. It's still an important number. If you doubt that, just think of every time any index, NASDAQ, Dow, S&P, if it passes a round number, if it goes 30,000, there's headlines everywhere. Why is that different than 29,999 or 30,001?
Well, very recently, and we noticed,
because we like it,
and we ever get around to talking about the market for the week, well, this will come up. We have been bouncing off the 3,000 number on the S&P 500 for 3 months. We'll get up to the 3,000 level,
bounce down, and promptly bounce down.
Why? I mean, what's so special? The earnings have fluctuated around, interest rates have fluctuated around, lots of things that happen.
Because it's a round number.
It's a psychological barrier. And it's real. Do we have to do commercials?
We do.
We could just skip.
That's why I was pointing at my watch.
We could skip commercials.
We could, but we won't.
All right.
We're going to play some commercials. If you'd like to call in, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side of these commercials.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. That's twice you've done this now.
What, that I've said my name?
We've said our names accurately.
We can say our names.
Telephone number in here, if today is October 26, 2019, where you are, is 254-773-1400. If it's not October 26th, then we're not here, and the telephone number remains the same, just we won't answer it. So you're welcome to call either way. Let's talk about the market for a second. The S&P 500, SPX, and why do I say SPX? Because that gives a definition to the numbers we're using, believe it or not, rose a delightful 1.22% for the week, closed at 3022.55, finally, at the end of a week, clearing the 3,000 ceiling. Now, what does that mean? That means that odds are it's either going to take off or it's going to get a slap back, but we'll see. Something's got to, because the trailing 3 months, it's down 0.11%. In essence, that's such a small number. The S&P 500 has been treading water for 3 months. And why does it go down? Why does it come up? It really rotates around something critical, and that is the trade war. Why did the market rise 1.22% for the week? That's a big rise for 1 week. Obviously, if you multiply that times 52 weeks, that would be a wow for the year. It's because of all the headlines saying this phase one deal with China is likely to pass. Now, we've talked about this before, and we recommend you not get too excited about this, because the phase one deal with China, if it goes through, and they haven't finally agreed on what it means exactly, really doesn't amount to much, except that China says at some point we'll buy some agricultural goods and we will reduce our theft of technology. Not eliminate it.
Now, these are aspirational, so they haven't set any rules in place to how they would do that.
Yeah, we'll try to stop some of the stealing of technology, and we will...
Well, why is that important?
Buy some food from you.
Because they wrote it down this time. Mm-hmm. That's important. They haven't done that in the past. And this goes about lots and lots of decades that they have aspirationally stated that they would do these things. Now they're aspirationally writing that they will do the things. That's a step.
But no point has anybody on our side said that the December 15th additional tariffs are going to go away or the tariffs are going to be lowered if they sign this deal. The market is trying to be a little optimistic, which is a good thing, I suppose, if you're invested in the market. But don't get too attached to the gains because fundamentally there's no major change. These are very, very minor points. And it's wonderful because we're not getting further apart, at least. And in other words, the fact that we're shooting each other less is a tremendous. We're not going to shoot. We're not going to attack each other any more than we're already attacking each other. Nobody has talked about them cutting tariffs or us cutting tariffs at this point, and we've still got some major tariffs incoming. Matter of fact, the Federal Trade the Trade Representative Lightsinger. Said that no, the tariffs in December are still very definitely on, and the additional tariffs, unless something major happens. So, I'm not trying to be pessimistic. The market may be being a little excessively optimistic in rising 1.22%. We'll see. And some of that's off earnings. Some of the earnings came back a little bit. Tesla was a big chunk of this. Tesla is now worth more than General Motors, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, and to when you consider some important factors here.
Well, they don't make
Tesla
anywhere near as many cars in the way of cars.
No, but the model car that they make, in each model that they make it, is the highest selling in that category of cars.
Hmm.
Every single model that they make is the top in the category for sales. So that says something. I'm not recommending Tesla. Tesla is a high-risk venture right now. They have to make a lot of high risks just to stay alive.
Matter of fact, their stock was up because they didn't lose money.
Right. But
which
you
was
can,
a surprise.
But we can also look at it and say part of the reason why they've done as well as they have is because they've done some pretty tremendous quality work. If you ever ride in a Tesla, it's an experience. It's a big deal.
Sure. It's way ahead of its time. It's the, you know what's kind of odd? It's the equivalent of the Stanley Steamer.
Yeah. And the Stanley Steamer did well until the internal combustion engine, a very cheap and.
Well, it was competing with internal combustion.
Right.
Engines.
Until it took off with the Model T and it just got flooded out of the market.
Right.
Because it was high end. So what they're struggling to do is have a mid-end, that is not an oxymoron. Can you have a mid-end?
Yes.
An end in the middle?
Yes.
Would it still be the middle if it has an end?
If it's a circle.
Is it an end? An outer end.
But does the end justify the means?
So the Tesla being as highly priced as it is when compared to General Motors, General Motors is not nimble. That is an understatement of the highest order. To change its structure, its plans, its focus is decades.
But they are one of the reasons the strike occurred, which, by the way, ended yesterday officially.
Yes, it finished, and we're all happy that it's over.
But one of the reasons the strike occurred is because General Motors wanted to close some of its internal combustion engine-based plants and open up electric car plants.
Right.
And it was going to open up the electric car plants with far fewer workers than had been in the previous plants that they were shutting down.
And this is what I mean by not nimble. As soon as they say that, their entire workforce says, nope, we're not coming to work then.
So there's a reason for a potential optimism. And we're back in, from the stock market point of view, very frankly, we're in a balancing point where the stock market is optimistic that the president will pull back on tariffs at some point because he wants to get reelected. And if he doesn't, I think we're in for a fall. If he does, we are in fall.
This is
October. We're in for a downslide in the market because the market is priced in some optimism. On the other hand, the market is conceivably could shoot up easily 15% if the tariffs were withdrawn.
Maybe more than that. I think easily 15% is correct. We might see a 20% increase just based on this. There's a lot of stuff that's just waiting.
Now, the other thing that's news in the markets is the yield curve has now been non-inverted for 2 weeks, which is a good thing. The problem with that is it didn't. The far end of it has risen. The Treasury 10-year note has risen to 1.8%. And you remember, if you've been listening very long, it wasn't terribly long ago where somebody called in and said, do you think we'll see 2% or 4% next? And the answer, of course, was 2%, although we didn't know it at the time. We are not recovered in the Treasury market to yields that were reasonable. A year ago, the yields at the 10-year point were closer to 3%, were above 3%. And the main thing that's happened to undo the yield curve inversion is the short end has dropped as money has been flooded in
right.
the short end.
It took the Federal Reserve dumping a lot of money into the short-term market to cause the interest rates to come down enough that we don't have an inverted yield curve. Is that an actual non-inverted
yield
curve?
Well, it is. It is. But here's the thing I'd warn people about. The yield curve historically has gone non-inverted about 6 months before the recession starts.
Yeah. So we have not changed the fact that it was inverted and extended its inversion. It's still the same symptom of unease by the bond market about the future.
I would still, this is just Jeff McClure doing a, what we call a swag, a scientific wild-ass guess. I would say the probability of a recession occurring in the next 12 months is still probably 75 to 85%. That's basically, historically, we're set up for a recession. On the other hand, I will say, if the president declares that he's won the trade war or we've won the trade war or however he wants to make a declaration and he pulls the tariffs Monday morning, the recession gets postponed, and it may get postponed a long time because we would have a surge in the economy and we'd have a surge across the board. The UAW ending the strike, that's wonderful. That's going to give a little boost to the economy. If we could get the Boeing back flying and making aircraft instead of parking aircraft in their parking lots, that would help a lot too. But we've got a lot of factors, and not the least of which is, and this is what's interesting. I don't want to be monologuing too long here. Let me get this out of the way. The market went up 1.22% despite the fact that durable goods orders in the United States were down 1.1% in September. Now, 1.1% doesn't sound like a lot, but again, multiply that times 12. And we've talked about in the past that durable goods orders are very, very important because durable goods are the things that people buy over time. They buy to hold for a long period of time. But just as importantly, capital goods, which is the stuff that companies buy to make more stuff, have been dropping for months and dropped again in September. They declined 2.8% in September. Businesses are not investing in future production. All the indicators out there right now have gone from positive, which they were at the early start of this recovery, through neutral and have turned negative. But the stock market went up, and I'm not saying that this is a fact and I'm not predicting exactly what's going to happen, but the very last stage of a bull market before the fall is when the economy turns south and the market turns north. When the market goes up and the economy is going down, and that can last for months. So I'm not saying to try to time the market get out. Certainly doesn't work. But I am saying that there is increased risk at this point because the market seems to have plugged in a disconnect from observable reality. And it's the market, what you said, die on euphoria?
Mm-hmm.
The market is somewhere between optimism and euphoria right now.
I'm not sure it's fully into euphoria because when we look at earnings, it's relatively fairly priced.
Right.
It needs to get way above fair price for us to say euphoria, but we're definitely on the top end of optimism.
So just be aware of that. Don't be surprised if you see things fall apart. On the other hand, and this is what's keeping the market up, don't be surprised if you see some announcements come out of Washington and everything suddenly turn around and come up roses and it'd be wonderful.
If we get good news on the trade front with Europe and with China, we're in good shape. If the trade war goes away, we're in excellent shape.
So there's a lot of wild cards in here. We're going to talk some more about the repo market and about the critical shortage of cash next hour.
And I wanted to throw something else in here because I just haven't heard it very much.
What's that?
It's Texas specific. The Speaker of the House for the Texas Legislature, Dennis Bonin, has agreed to resign. Have you been following that? He was nearly unanimously elected by Democrats and Republicans at the end of the last legislative session. But he had a recording of him saying some pretty unnice things about almost everybody. And it's caused a backlash. But that's happened. We're about out of time this hour. That could have repercussions for a lot of things. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at 254-947-1111. You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Read our newsletter and our philosophy. Listen to recorded programs from the past. And contact us. There's a contact form or email directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this is The Personal Wealth.